Welcome to MacGuffman. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James.
Yo.
Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. Most recently, we talked about Ex Machina. I also wrote a thing this week about Ex Machina, the Avengers, and Aziz Ansari, for some reason, and how they all talk about technology, so you can check that out at themacguffinmen.com. Also, follow us on Twitter. At the MacGuffinmen, no underscores. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us 5-star ratings. Tell all your friends about us. And find a millionaire benefactor to pay us money to do this. But yeah, we'll just get right to the podcast.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yep.
What are we talking about here?
We are talking about Mad Max, : Fury Road.
Yes.
a movie that came out recently is doing very well by, it seems, every measure to measure movie success. Mm-hmm. Making a ton of money and pleasing critics and audiences alike.
Yeah.
Obviously, I guess what George Miller is calling a revisiting of the Mad Max series. The first one came out in 1979 with Mel Gibson and very much launched his career. Mm-hmm. And this, the fourth one in its many attempted incarnations has been kind of kicking around development hell for a while, but mm-hmm. They got it together and it's out now and mission accomplished.
The movie exists. You did it, George.
Good work. Yeah. Did you realize kind of how long they had been trying to do this fourth one?
I knew it had been talked about for a long time. And one of the things I said, I was talking to our friend Travis about this the other day. I remember the casting of Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron being announced way earlier than you would expect for a movie that eventually ended up coming out in May 2015. Like, I remember being 2010 or 2011 when I started hearing about this movie is definitely happening now. You know? And even just in that capacity, it took them a while to get going. And I was watching, I don't know if you saw this, there's a about 18 minutes of just unedited B-roll footage, or just basically just very loosely compiled B-roll footage on YouTube from the set of this film. And on the like whenever you see a clapper, which is what they'll snap in between at the beginning of a take so that they can line up audio and video in editing, it's the date is 2012 and everything, and then this movie wrapped shooting in 2012, and here we are now with the actual movie. And it had been in the makings for a long time and had various derailments, but
Yeah, and George Miller, the director, at least from what I've been able to gather, isn't someone who just talks about projects a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a Quentin Tarantino who apparently has 70 movies he almost made last week.
Yeah.
But he talked about it and kind of had very detailed reasons about why this didn't go well and kind of the financial collapse in the States affecting the American dollar, so the budget got out of control, and then the Iraq War kind of starting near where they planned on shooting. They wanted to do a 3D animated feature and changed his mind, and then they had a set and that got unexpected heavy rains and kind of turned into a very flush, beautiful green place, which mm-hmm. is not what this movie is supposed to depict at all. And so, yeah, as you said, even kind of once it did get started, it was still there shooting in 2012. And as you said, 2015 is when we got it. But yeah, just a very kind of complicated story to try to get this one going. And, the first one came out 36 years ago now. So it has been quite a gap since, from the first original version to this one finally coming out. But we got it.
Yeah, exactly. And the one thing you didn't even mention there was Mel Gibson was still going to be Mad Max when this movie first started being talked about being made, and pretty much the 2006 cancellation, or whenever around that time that they had to cancel it, it sort of just became a thing that Mel Gibson no longer really wanted to do, partially because he was old. Eventually, you know, by the time this movie did actually get made, I don't think he would have been able to play the part because of the way his life has taken a turn in the past decade. One of the other things I really enjoy about this movie is how people address why Mel Gibson isn't playing Mad Max in this movie. They call it because of his toxic situation or something like that.
Yeah, I saw his general radioactivity. I think
that was Papademos that said Alex Papademos that said that. But yeah. It was kind of like when Ben Roethlisberger was in the Super Bowl against the Green Bay Packers the last time. It's just like, how are they going to mention this without mentioning this?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and I think Heath Ledger was going to be Mad Max for a little bit, too, from reliable sources.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, that took another unfortunate turn.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's get to the movie. You saw this before I did, and you told me that I should see it because I was pretty apprehensive about it. I'd seen the first one and liked the first one. The 1979 version, I mean, mm-hmm. And seeing the trailer for this, I just really wasn't that excited. It looked kind of just like weird for the sake of weird. And while this movie definitely has a lot of weird things, I don't find it as just to be weird. I think that they ended up making a very good movie out of it. So I was happy to be proven wrong on that account.
Yeah. I had no attachment to the Mad Max movies. I hadn't seen any of them until about a week and a half ago when a mutual friend of ours sent me a message saying that she was watching all of them and that they were fun. And I was like, and that I should check them out. And I did. And I liked all of them. Even Beyond Thunderdome has an wonderful highlight in it. When this trailer came out, I had kind of the exact opposite reaction to you, whereas I was like excited about its potential weirdness. Like that was what I was thinking. And we had this conversation before the movie came out. I was like, it might be terrible, but at least it will be different and at least it will be weird. And in big budget movies in 2015, sometimes that's the best you can hope for. But the good news is that's not the best you can hope for, because the best you can hope for is pretty much Mad Max Fury Road, because I believe I described this movie to you in a text message as fun balls, and that's why we should do a podcast on it. Yeah, I really, really liked this movie. And I love action movies, and the older I get, the rarer it is for me to see an action movie that makes me really excited, both for combinations of the way, you know, the fact that I'm just older and, you know, I can't get as excited as I would have as a 14-year-old, and also just the way action has gone in cinema. I was really happy about Mad Max. I saw it with my friend Dawson, and like as the title card comes up as Max is being recaptured by the War Boys, and the Mad Max Fury Road pops up, Dawson looks over to me like, we made a smart decision. and that's pretty much how everybody feels about this movie that I've talked to, and certainly how I feel about this movie.
Yeah, I think it was a lot of fun. I think it actually had a bit more heft to it than just being, as you would say, fun balls. But
oh yeah, definitely.
Well, what do you want to talk about first, the fun balls or the heft? or the heft of those fun balls?
I don't know. It's tricky because they go so hand in hand throughout the film. So
okay, well, yeah, right off the bat, I did. I enjoyed the opening narration. Mm-hmm. It's a movie without a ton of dialogue.
Yeah.
I thought they kind of set the tone quickly, and you know, it's something that kind of gets revisited a few times throughout the movie, but just that idea of being you know, hunted by the ones trying to kill him and haunted by all the people he couldn't save, for a character who doesn't speak often, I thought that even just that little intro there kind of gave some gravity to the situation. And you know, it is a post apocalyptic world, so there's going to be some gravity to it already, but you can do that and kind of have it be hollow. And I thought this one was you know, for a character who doesn't get to say much, kind of rounded out at least decently right off the bat.
Oh yeah, for sure. And it's very economical and not hacky, and gives you pretty much everything you need to know about Max and nothing that you don't need to know about Max. You don't need to know what he was drinking out of that can that he kicks over when he gets into his car to drive away from the war boys immediately after. But you know that he has various sadnesses following him around.
Yeah, no, it's funny you use the term economical because I was thinking about this movie and it is simultaneously extremely efficient and wildly excessive at the same time, depending on which elements of the movie you're talking about. Do you know what I mean?
Not entirely.
Okay. Well, I mean, for a movie that has, I guess we got to get to it at one point, like an army that constantly has a electric guitar player that has fire coming out of the end of his guitar and kind of all these very excessive, extravagant, you know, visual things. It does, you know, like there isn't a ton of dialogue, and I think that they get a lot out there without having to, you know, spoon feed you. I think that just the way that it's edited together, I think, is very impressive. You know, we kind of get these very, you know, it's, there's so much action in this movie, but you still kind of can keep up with it. Like there's, it's so extravagant and insane in so many ways, but I think it does, I think it manages to accomplish a lot pretty efficiently.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the key decisions that, you know, was made, or maybe not even made, it was just so a part of the fabric of the film early on, is that there's just no exposition. Like, it's a movie that lets you fill in the gaps. Like, again, I mentioned Alex Papademos earlier. I was listening to him talk about Mad Max on this movie and or Mad Max on his podcast, and he's talking about how Furiosa's arm in a Marvel movie that has like this long important speech about why she has this arm and it was torn off by a blimp and that's why she's afraid of blimps or whatever is the thing he comes up with. And in this movie it's just like, well, she's missing an arm, you know, and you can decide as to why. Like, and there's obviously enough thought put into various parts of this movie that you kind of trust that there's thought behind everything. And it's this one of those imperceptible things in film direction that we always talk about, that you kind of need to do the work even if the work isn't really present. Like, there's something about it that people can feel. And like, I don't know what Furiosa's backstory is. I am confident George Miller has a pretty detailed one for her, you know? And I think one of the things I read about the first Mad Max, I think it might have been the producer, Byron Kennedy, talking about it, who passed away died in the 80s. The first Mad Max was designed around the idea that when there actually is an environmental crisis, the government will have waited and too long and to act. Like, they will have tried something, but only when the signs of definite crisis were coming. And that's not something that's mentioned in Mad Max, but it's something that shows all throughout the entirety of the movie. And I think that sort of thought permeates all the future Mad Max movies, and definitely shows in Fury Road. You know, like, we see scars on characters all throughout the movie. We don't need to know necessarily why the scars are there, because we can get a good enough idea. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, yeah, and just, you know, like Furiosa's arm, we get kind of into it a little bit when Nux talks about the bumps on him, and he's named them Larry and Barry, but we don't understand what causes them. You know, it's just an illness. We don't really understand what's wrong with the war boys that they need to have these humans act as blood bags for them for constant blood transfusions, but Max has to deal with it, so we'll deal with it too. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Max probably doesn't know either.
yeah, true. And like a lot of future movies and future dystopic movies, I enjoy the use of language a lot. Like, you know, blood bag. They kind of say it once; it never gets explained. We don't have that. You know, we don't have that character who is the outsider who acts as the proxy for the audience and has everything explained to them. You know what I mean? Like, it's, that just happens. And, you know, they'll say, oh, you're a rev head, he can fix it. You know, rev head, it takes a second, but you can piece it together. It's like a gearhead, it's a mechanic, it's all these things. And, you know, they kind of blow through all these words, and some of them you hear once, some of them you hear a few times. But, you know, that's just, you know, not spoon feeding you. You know, they, you know, polecats, you know, there's a bunch of these uses of language where it's just slang that inevitably would be developed because this is their reality. And, you know, I think it's fun as a audience member to like pick those out and pick up on them and try to explain them. And, obviously there is a reason for them. And as you said, even if it's not, you know, spelled out for you on the screen, obviously there is at least one person involved with the production who knows all of that.
Yeah, exactly. I love all of those, minor linguistic challenges throughout the movie. I enjoy them thoroughly. It kind of actually reminds me of like listening to a Raekwon or Ghostface record and all of the nonsense slang that they make up, but also makes sense by the time the next line starts. And yeah, that stuff's always really fun. And you're exactly right in that you need to know that they know what they're talking about, but they don't need to tell you they know what they're talking about. You know?
Yeah. So. And another thing about kind of this just being a, you know, simultaneously having a lot going on and not a lot going on, simultaneously being really extravagant and efficient. This movie is essentially people driving in a straight line and then driving back.
Yeah.
You know, it's point A to B and then back to A.
It's people driving in a straight line, making a 90-degree turn, continuing on that line, and then people drive at a different angle in a straight line to catch up with them, and then everybody turns around.
Yeah, okay, that's right. That is more accurate.
Yeah. Let's not pretend like there isn't one turn in this movie aside from the turnaround. Yeah.
The big plot deviation right there. Yeah. And, you know, speaking about other dystopian future movies, I read George Miller saying he didn't want to look like every other futuristic movie or dystopian future movie. It's not super desaturated colors. You know, partly there's bright reds and oranges, and, you know, it's obviously we've got the desert colors, but the cars and the things that they wear, and, you know, there's so many things that we don't just get bleak grays and beiges the entire time. Like, it is a very colorful movie, and so much of it pops off the screen. Like, you know, I don't, we'll probably mention this fire guitar player a few more times, but I think he fits in this part of the discussion as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, everything in this movie is oversaturated. And I go back and forth on whether or not I like it. I certainly like that it wasn't, you know, that not everything was gray and
washed out.
Yeah, exactly. It's not the Terminator Salvation color scheme. But, it's kind of the opposite of one of the things that I love about this movie, which is all the practical stunt work. Whereas all of this color correction is done in post, and they're just kind of like cranking dials and being like, make the sky bluer, you know? And they're like building windows around this one lamp that the wives are holding so that they can have this natural firelight, but everything around it has to be this very digital blue. And I think, if anything in this movie doesn't age well, it's going to be the colors. And, that's the hesitation I have about it. But yeah, you know, if you do one thing wrong, that's all right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, and I already kind of talked about how this movie is, you know, it's two things simultaneously. It's extravagant and it's efficient.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And yeah, I think you kind of pointed onto another dichotomy there of all the practical stunt work, which I definitely want to get to, and this kind of stuff being done in post-production. And on plenty of our podcasts, you've talked about how much you like in-camera effects and practical effects and things like that. And, you know, as you said, with the colors in this one, that is very, you know, that's post-production. But I think the harder part and the more interesting part is the stunt work and those kinds of practical effects, which for the most part, as far as I understand, is pretty real. Yeah, George Miller said, I think he said 90%, and someone else, a producer maybe, said 80% of what you see on screen is really there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they did not cut Charlize Theron's arm off. There are some things that are to be done by green screen, and I don't think anyone's going to argue against them.
Yeah.
But there's just tons of practical effects. I mean, it's something like 150 stuntmen, including Cirque du Soleil members and Olympic athletes. That's just a huge number of stuntmen and, you know, hundreds of cars being crashed and just so like our guitar player, even the fire coming out of his guitar was real. Mm-hmm. Like he was really playing. That's a an Australian guitarist who his name is Iota. And, you know, he came out and, you know, before they were shooting, practiced playing guitar blindfolded on the front of a car driving around the desert and practiced his solos and was able to shoot fire at the end of his guitar by pressing on the whammy bar on his guitar. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just it's so much easier to take the shortcut with the CGI. And it's I don't think I could watch this version and the hypothetical CGI version and pick out exactly what it is. But it's just, you know, it's just so much more real. It's so much more fun, and it's just so much more impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, you're right. I think I don't know. I take the percentage estimates that the director and various stunt coordinators come up with as with a grain of salt. But yeah, it's very clear that most of these things are done practically, and it seems like the majority of the effects shots in this movie are like deleting harnesses and stuff like that. And you know, there's a lot of green screening on things where they have to like change the background behind somebody. Like they need to shoot Tom Hardy on the top of this truck, but for this specific scene they're doing too much to be able to move the truck, so they need to make the background move in post. But you've still got Tom Hardy on top of a truck being picked up by a polecat, you know, like yeah. So it's still an impressive stunt that they've just sort of augmented with CGI. But yes, the stunt work in this movie is amazing. The action sequences in this movie are amazing. Yeah,
polecats, of which polecats, there are three polecats. Very long ones.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Or yeah, one very long one, depending on how you want to talk yeah about the movie.
Yeah, I remember, like, everyone who's kind of told me about this movie was saying that it's, you know, one long action sequence. And, well, it's not entirely true, because mm-hmm I was wondering how they'd ever be able to maintain that. Like, you kind of have to let up at some point during a two-hour movie, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But it is pretty much one chase scene, and there's just a few kind of moments of, you know, dialogue, discussion at times, where it tones down quite a bit, but it is still an impressive amount of just straight up action sequences and chases.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, all of them wonderful.
Yes. And I actually kind of forgot about the polecats from the trailer for a bit. Oh, and then when they showed up. Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Lots of fun. Did you read A.O. Scott's review of this one from New York Times?
I did not. I bet it's wonderful. He's a good writer.
Yes, and he was very very pleased with this and was talking about some of the influences of it and some of the directors that, you know, he felt clearly had some kind of influence on George Miller. Mm-hmm. And he specifically points out Chuck Jones, who would do the Roadrunner cartoons. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, there are some things that are very realistic, but let's not pretend like this is all very realistic. I mean, we're talking about all the practical effects, you know, being real and impressive, but it's still an action movie. We still, you know, have to suspend disbelief a little bit for sure, some of the physics going on during this film.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I mean, even with these stunts, they're performing all of these things in very, like, they're in 1 second segments that they then splice together. You know, that's like, this guy does a motorcycle jump. All right, now we break for half an hour to set up the other motorcycle jump that will then be edited together to be like immediately sequential and will blow your fucking mind. But like, but it takes, you know, you've got to suspend some belief for sure.
Yeah, yeah, it's still an action movie.
Yeah, exactly. Moral of the story, it's still an action movie.
What about the increased and decreased frame rates? Does that bug you at all, or do you like that?
I like it. Well, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say necessarily that I like it, but I don't have a problem with it in a way that I think if you were to describe the technique to me that I would. And that was something that jumped out at me the first time I was watching the original Mad Max, was that there's a lot of cranking of the frame rates or the speed of the footage. And I was just like, yeah, it's a low budget movie. You got to generate excitement however you can. It's and it's the 1970s or late 70s. You know, you only have so many tricks up your sleeve. And then that ended up continuing through the sequels, and I was like, wow, maybe this is just a thing. But I assumed there would be none of it in Fury Road. But I think it actually kind of works in Fury Road. I feel like it adds to the hectic feel and the off-kilter feel of the entire movie. There's nothing that really you can point to and be like, normalcy. That is normalcy in this film. And I think that that certainly helps. There are certainly things that I don't like. There's this moment towards the end when they return to
Citadel.
Yeah, that's Citadel. And after Max throws Joe off the hood of the truck or whatever, there's a shot of Tom Hardy that they just used in reverse as he turns back to look up at Joe's brother, who's going to either let them up or not. And it just, that I hate that, cause that felt like something that was done because they didn't have a shot of Tom Hardy looking up, and they're just like, well, how can we do this? Well, we have him looking down. Let's reverse it and use that. That didn't feel like an idea that was constructed. Whereas before it was done, it just felt like they had to cover their ass. And that's the type of thing that jumps out to me. Whereas George Miller has kind of explained that, or perhaps it was the editor has explained that the frame rate thing is just that George Miller wanted the audience, like he wanted the shot to go as quickly as possible and everybody to understand what was happening. So if the shot moved a bit too slow, he would just speed up Tom Hardy running until it was just about to become incomprehensible. And then it was just like, no, that's it. We run the shot at 136%, you know? And that's
how it works. Yeah. I think it was John Seale, the cinematographer. Because I don't quote who came out of retirement for this movie. Mm-hmm. And is Australian as well and has worked with George Miller a lot. But he said, if George couldn't understand what was happening in the shot, he slowed it down until he could. And if it was too well understood, they would just shorten it or speed it up. And that's why there's so much manipulation of the frame rates. And I think that works. Like, and I think that's something that, again, like the feel of things being rushed like that kind of seems like that extravagant thing again. But then having a shorter shot just because you get everything you need out of a shorter shot or a sped up shot, I think is really efficient and mm-hmm. makes everything very intense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I enjoy the action sequence. You know, so much of it is on the cars, and those are very, very unique, fight scenes and everything, and are a lot of fun. But I enjoy the one where he first catches up with Furiosa. Yeah.
Love that sequence. It gets me all amped up.
Yeah, I mean, it's just very, like, just a lot of really interesting elements to make kind of a new sort of fight scene. You know, Max is chained to Nux through the door, and Furiosa doesn't have her prosthetic arm on at that point. And, Max knows his gun is misfiring, so he's kind of just using it as an empty threat. It's just a bunch of elements that made up for a really interesting fight scene that I couldn't think of something comparable to.
Yeah, for sure. And especially the way at the very end of the scene or the end of the fight where Nux actually helps Max load his gun. It's a very like it's a very nice little teamwork sort of moment, and I think it's great. Like, Nux is fighting for the clip while Max is fighting for the gun, and they end up coming together, and Nux like slides the stood up clip underneath the gun. Max, you know, picks up the clip with the handle of the butt of the gun and then cocks it on his leg and fires off three warning shots next to Charlize Theron's head. A lot of bullets going off right next to people's heads in this movie.
Yeah.
A lot of people that should be deaf.
Yeah, I don't know about the realism of some of that. Yeah. But no, that part you're describing felt like very good white doveless John Woo to me. Like, very, you know, really creative, like kind of small scale and close, but really, really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
And New York Times did you see that scene that they did with George Miller kind of doing a bit
anatomy
of director's
of a scene
over?
Sort of thing? No, I didn't.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. He talks about that and how it would have been difficult for the editor to kind of put together all of this footage to make that seamless, but still in a way that you can make sense of it and understand mm-hmm. what's going on the entire time. Mm-hmm. and I had never used this, heard this term used before, and he uses it a few times, but he talks about how creamy the editing is to have it all, like, to have so much going on and still have it really smooth like that. He says creamy like 3 times in 2 minutes or something. And I've never heard it, but it, you know, it works. Like, I think, yeah. I know, you know, you can tell exactly what he means.
Yeah, for sure.
We talk about the kind of geography of fight scenes and, mm-hmm. you know, not being lost and just how hectic it is. Did you think this movie was successful at that?
Yeah, because you don't really need to know a lot about the space that they're in, because the space they're in is just space, you know, like it's just, when in doubt. Yeah, that space exists, you know, like there's no, it's not a room that this this sequence is taking place in. The most complex chase sequence that exists, you know, geographically, is just when they're going through the I don't even remember what they call it, but you know, it's the motorcycle, the rock people, the motorcycle chase sequence.
Yeah.
And all you need to know is that the war rig is always in the center of, it's always in the place that you can drive. It's always in the road portion of things. And the motorcycles tend to be jumping around on the hills, you know?
Yeah.
So it's very simple. And just by simplifying it, it makes the action sequence so much better, because you know where the war rig is always going to be. So you have this central central thing to relate everything else to.
Yes. You know? When driving through a canyon, don't drive into the rocks on the side, stay in the road in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean, but it's, I mean, the chase is so linear and then the fighting is so lateral, you know, it's like Warwick's always usually just driving straight forward and then the fighting is coming off the side. And mm-hmm. yeah, I think, like, you're right, by simplifying it, I think that it definitely kind of makes you more aware. And then what, other than being in the canyon, it's usually just flat open desert. So exactly. You don't need to know about, you know, the placement of a pillar that someone's hiding behind or something like that.
Yeah. And you were talking about creamy editing, and there's a really great,
I always am.
Yes. Always are. there's a really great edit in the canyon sequence. The first time they're going through it, where you get this beautiful wide shot of the motorcycles flying through the air. And there's one just reaching the top of its jump in the wide shot. And then you cut to, the cab where Charlize Theron Furiosa and Max are sort of fighting. I think Furiosa is shooting out of the top and Max is shooting out the window. And, you know, half a second goes by and then the motorcyclist that was clearly going to land on the side of Max on the cab just flies past Max, is in the frame, or is in the shot for maybe 5 frames. And it's clearly a person, and it was so perfectly timed. And the fact, like, it's those little things that make this movie so much better than other action movies, is that most people wouldn't think that that's an important thing to have, this continuation between one shot to the next. And even, you know, the amount of effort it took to get that guy in the frame for 5 frames, you know, is insane. But it's that type of attention to detail that I think this movie has that really elevates it, you know, on a wider scale.
Yeah.
It's all of these little small decisions that are made that make the movie feel grander.
Yeah. We've called it an action a million times, but there's definitely a Western vibe going on too, right?
Oh, absolutely. All of the Mad Max sequels are quasi-Westerns. I mentioned this to you that they're, after I watched The Road Warrior last week, that it felt kind of like a post-apocalyptic Man with No Name movie. And then I watched Beyond Thunderdome that night, and Mad Max is actually referred to as the Man with No Name in Beyond Thunderdome. And yeah, there really is that vibe. And one of the most Western, or Sergio Leone, for example, aspects of this movie is, and it's so small, but it's I think adds so much, is the way that sound is used in sort of the quieter moments. And like when you can hear a character walking in this empty space, and you know, Max has his leather coat on with a couple of chains at his side, and he's got his leg brace and all of these things, and you can hear all of these little tiny sounds that come even when he's just moving, just to walk up to Furiosa to point to the something on the map and be like, this is where we should go, it's better to go back to the Citadel or whatever. And you hear the sound effects of everything on him, but there's no other sound going on because there's no music in the scene, and there's just no sound around them because they're in the desert. And that's something that I think is carries through all of Leone's Westerns and is very important to sort of setting or creating this tone of open space where you can hear every little thing, where every it's this giant space where little things are happening, but all the little things matter. And it's the way that these movies use sound that I think kind of elevates that. It's just another one of those little things that makes the movie better on a big scale.
Yeah. What else is Western-y about Fury Road in particular?
Well, we've got the man with no name. We've got the way that he sounds. We've got it's kind of got a stagecoach vibe to it.
Stagecoach slash train, because like it's such a linear journey, right?
Yeah,
like
exactly.
It's there and back, like train tracks.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. And you know, the motorcycles might as well just be horses, and Joe's various cars could just be carriages and whatnot.
Fire guitars might as well be fiddles.
Exactly. just get Marcus Mumford playing a fiddle with a whammy bar, and let's see what happens. Let's make the folk rock version of this movie.
No, thank you. I mean, you touched on it with The Man with No Name, but we have, you know, a very little spoken character who, you know, the stranger who comes into town and saves it from the evil male or patriarchy, as George Miller says in this case.
Yep. The white male pig.
Did you want to touch on the gender stuff in this movie, or did you get that all out of your system on Ex Machina?
well, that's what I was thinking of after I saw this movie, and we talked about doing a podcast on it. I think the last thing I said on our Ex Machina podcast was the patriarchy wins again. The patriarchy does not win this week, folks.
No.
So it gets its face ripped off by Charlize Theron.
Which brings the score to $5 billion for the patriarchy.
But they've got their women have their rally caps on now. They're ready to go.
Yeah, I think people are talking about this movie a lot because, you know, it's got 98% on Rotten Tomatoes and it's making a ton of money. But I think there's plenty of articles kind of being written about the gender subject in this. And George Miller has talked about it. He did say this is about taking down the patriarchy. So it's not as though people are just injecting something into it where it doesn't exist.
Oh, yeah.
Take it whatever way you want. I've been reading other, you know, people taking both sides on it, but it's definitely there. It's definitely kind of gender charged. It's something that, you know, he's explicitly stated. And he even asked the editor, who's a female, Margaret Siegel, you know, she had never done an action movie, and she asked why he would want her to do this. And he said, because if a guy did it, it would just look like every other action movie. And Eve Ensler, the writer of the vagina monologues and feminist, was consulted about the portrayal of female characters in this movie. So it's definitely not, it was not far from his mind during the making of this film.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's pretty clear if this movie existed and there were no feminist undertones intended, I would be very confused as to how George Miller's mind works. You know?
Yeah, very disappointed that he can't see what he's doing.
Also, Margaret Siegel is George Miller's wife.
Yes, I knew that. He doesn't mention that in that Anatomy of the Scene thing, so I was going to let it slide.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I mean, there's literally a scene where our, you know, male protagonist washes away blood.
Yeah.
With mother's milk, like word for word.
Yeah.
So it's hard not to kind of see how charged a lot of the imagery and dialogue in this movie is.
Oh yeah, for sure.
All right. Nothing more on that.
Okay. No, I I think it, I mean, it runs all throughout the movie. There's one of my favorite moments in the movie is probably, I forget what Rosie Huntington-Whiteley's character's name is. I mean, all of these characters' names are so bananas that, you know, you're never going to forget like, I know Zoe Kravitz's character is named Toast the Knowing. You know, I know this because how can you forget that?
Yeah.
But, Yeah, I forget a lot of them. But anyways, Rosie Huntington-Whiteley, during the first canyon sequence, I believe, as Nux is deflecting sort of blame for why he's doing what he's doing. He's like, well, it's because of Joe and all these things. And then she just yells, then who killed the world? And like pushes him out of the car. And it's just like, yeah, you just can't keep deflecting blame. Sometimes you're the one to blame. And the war boys are following in Joe's footsteps. And Joe is to blame, you know? And I enjoyed that moment a lot. And even though it's extremely on the nose, it's still it still works somehow. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think it's like you always say, you know, if they do everything else really well, then things like that don't stand out as glaringly terrible.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
Yeah.
Is this movie much different than the other kind of summer tentpole movies, or is the difference being blown out of proportion?
I think the difference, no. My short answer is no. But of course, the answer is more complicated than that. Because it certainly action-packed, has a lot of similar beats. It's got the climactic action sequence, all these. It's got the action sequence to set up the character at the beginning. It's got all of this stuff. But what it doesn't have is the entire world is not in danger. At the most, in this movie, it seems like the worst-case scenario is 100 people die. And that's a big difference than, say, the Avengers, you know, or any other Marvel movie where it seems like the world is always at stake. So that's big. The stakes are smaller somehow makes it different. What else is there? I don't know. That's a big one for sure. Do you have anything in mind?
No, I mean, it kind of came up when you were talking about the Avengers before, and you know, you said it again with the kind of the way the Marvel movies were. Just that, like the way that the Marvel movies, everything, it's the entire universe and the use of infinity, the word that comes up a lot, it's kind of points to the fact that you can't heighten anymore. You know what I mean? And, you know, through the plot or through either visuals, you're kind of maxing out, I think. Mm. And it seems like something has to change. Mm-hmm. I mean, and there's going to be superhero movies for another while, and they're still going to be the biggest movies that are being made. But it seems like something has to change or differ at one point.
Yeah, yeah. Like you were saying, the Infinity Stones are important to the Avengers, but there's a very finite amount of stones in this film. You can see them all, and you know that none other are going to come into play. Thanos isn't going to appear at the end and be like, no, four more movies.
There's one tree.
Yeah, exactly. Some people don't know what a tree is in this movie. That was another little thing that I enjoyed, that Nux just didn't know what a tree was, and that is never discussed, really. It's just like, that's a tree. It's like, yeah, okay, tree. I thought that was a nice thing.
And he quickly calls it a tree thing, as they're rushing to get going, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, just sort of the fact that this movie feels finite. Like, If the next Mad Max movie continues on the tradition of other Mad Max movies, we're done with the Citadel. You know, like Mad Max is just gone. And I think that one of the things that runs through all these movies, and very much through Fury Road, and something that I like a lot, is that Max understands that he can't make a big difference on the world. Like the world has already gone to shit, and it's just, the only job he can really do is kind of just survive within it. And we see a lot of him through the first third just trying to avoid helping anybody, you know, like he just wants to get away from everything. Even when he's in Furiosa's truck for the first time, he's basically just trying to get himself away from the war boys, Joe and the Citadel and all that stuff. He just wants to survive by himself. And part of that seems to be because in the past, when he has helped other people out, he's ended up failing, and those failures haunt him. Most notably with his dead daughter. Other people show up in the movie, and the idea is that those are from previous adventures that we just never will find out about. And those are the people that are haunting him. And he knows that even in successes, or sorry, that he can only affect such a small part of the world that he can never fix the world. So why even try? You know, like there's this real kind of existentialist element to Max at the beginning, especially. And eventually he sort of gets brought in with Furiosa and her gang, and basically accepts that, you know, like Max is a man, he's trying to make small differences in this vast wasteland, and that's the best you can hope for. And that is what puts it in what contrasts it from other summer blockbusters, I think, is that everybody else is trying to save the whole wasteland at once, whereas this movie understands that's too much for one movie. You know, like you can't focus on that and have it be like a thing that people can get really invested in, you know?
Yeah, and even when, you know, as you said, he's just trying to do these little things to help, he helps very reluctantly.
Like, yes, extremely.
He only, you know, goes with the women because that's his chance to survive. You know what I mean? It's not, there really isn't that moment where he wants to leave and then turns around because he has to. No, he tries to leave, but Furiosa has utilized the kill switches in such a way that he can't go without them. Like he needs them to move forward, and that's why they kind of create this team. Mm-hmm. And I think another thing that separates this from, you know, a common summer blockbuster and aligns it with westerns again, particularly The Man with No Name, is that he walks away at the end, and our main male and our main female characters find love together and are gonna live their lives together. He, you know, there's a moment of acknowledgement and they nod to each other, but then he goes away. And, you know, we'll see in the inevitable sequels if they really stick to that. But so far that it appears that's it. You know, there is nothing more to it. And he's going to go and try to live his own life in his own way. And, you know, he will get pulled into something else. But I really did enjoy, as someone who does enjoy the Man with No Name movies and westerns of that area a lot, I like that that's how it was left.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not like he doesn't accumulate another additional person to haunt him throughout this movie, depending on how strongly you think he felt about Nux. By the end of the movie, he's got Nux, and he certainly has Rosie Huntington Whiteley's death, at least in some capacity, on him, because the movie seems to make it clear that she was okay, and then she slipped because of she didn't have her right leg at full strength because Max shot her in it previously, and that kind of leads to her death. And and I think that's one of the things in this movie that I found really interesting, was that Max succeeds at the end, but he still doesn't succeed with what his goal at the very beginning of the movie, that monologue was that I'm a man just here to survive and to run away from the things that haunt me. And he does survive, but he gets an additional thing to haunt him, and a pregnant woman died partially because of him. And
yeah,
that's so fascinating. And that's sorry, a dead pregnant woman is something that separates this movie from summer blockbusters also.
I was just about to say that I don't enjoy seeing pregnant women die, but if you do that kind of fallout of one and get run over by a truck, or maybe run over by a truck, I'm glad they didn't take the shortcut out and, you know, they stuck to their guns. And that is something that is, as you said, not typical of any movie, let alone your summer blockbuster. So
yeah, somebody, one of the times I saw this movie, somebody full on like gasped when that happened. Yeah. Because yeah, that, of course, that's a thing that doesn't happen in movies. It's not a part of blockbuster film grammar, you know? It was really fascinating. And not only that, like, pregnant woman dies, we then see Joe holding her corpse, in like just carrying her corpse, and it's just a weird, awkward shot. And and then later, the medic,
postmortem cesarean section,
yeah, exactly. And just the way, like, the dead baby's never shown, but is thrown like down like it's a cut of meat at a butcher shop. Like, it's crazy. And it's that type of thing would seem exploitive if it didn't have some sort of meaning. And the thing that it adds to Max's inner struggle, I think, is totally worth the potential offensiveness of killing a pregnant woman. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the organic mechanic is his role, according to the credits.
That sounds like a name in a Mad Max movie.
Sure does. Yep. Toast the organic mechanic.
Yep. Sounds right.
Cool. Anything else on Mad Max?
I want to know how you felt about Tom Hardy in this movie.
I still don't know.
Okay. Yeah, because I want to talk about Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron both. I think they both deserve. Because I told Travis this after I saw Mad Max. I am fully on the Tom Hardy bandwagon now. I was where you were, and was just like, I don't know where I stand. But this movie, I think he's amazing in this movie, and I understand. It's like he's got that real like Pacino in the '90s vibe, where it's like we're clearly past his prime Pacino, but it's pre him going like being in Jack and Jill Pacino, where it's Pacino in Heat. Like he still gives a good performance with all of these weird silly tics. Like he's always chewing gum for no reason, and you know there's a reason behind it. It's like, well, he's in Heat, his character was a former addict, and that never gets established, or an addict, and that never gets established in the movie, but Pacino was thinking that the whole time. And Tom Hardy really feels like that kind of performer. It's Pacino in 1995, and I love that. He's so watchable, and he's a very physical performer too, which I enjoy. And he has all of these tics, and I really enjoy it. And George Miller humorously compared Hardy to the animals in Babe, because George Miller wrote the first Babe movie and directed the second. He said Tom Hardy in this movie has to be simultaneously lovable and dangerous, and that's what he thought about the animals in Babe. But I thought that was fairly apt, and I don't know, there's just something so goddamn watchable about Tom Hardy, and I feel like in blockbuster movies it's never going to be a bad thing to have him being the fucking weirdo that he seems to be on screen, you know?
Yeah, overall I'm on board. Did you see Lawless?
I did see Lawless.
Yeah, he kind of—I mean, it's almost similar. He's definitely more active physically in this one than he was in Lawless. But it's a lot of grunting and head gesturing and nodding in place of dialogue.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I'm glad though, and I always want the best for him. And it seems as though he's signed on for 3 more Mad Max movies. So yeah. You're in luck.
Yeah, exactly. I'm pleased with that. And I thought Charlize Theron was really good as well. And You know, we've talked about how little dialogue there is in this movie, and both actors that gives both actors such a challenge, because the primary thing that people think of when they think of actors is actors reading their lines. You know, that's the thing that people think about for the very basis of acting, is that, well, people give you the sheet with words on it and you read those words. What if that sheet doesn't have words on it? And a lot of the script of this movie, well, it's got words on it, but they're in square brackets. So it's just actions, and it's not things that they actually get to say. And I thought Charlize Theron really got this, that quality across as well. And I liked how it really seems like, at least my perception of the movie, it seems like Furiosa is at least in some capacity complicit for what happens, or for, you know, helping Joe to keep the five wives caged up, at least for a while. And this is sort of her redemption, is her getting them away from Joe. And I like that. I don't know. I feel like it's so hard to perform the killing of the villain and make it sort of be this moment that is well acted. And I think she did a really good job there. And I just, in general, I feel like there's some sort of presence in Charlize Theron throughout this movie that is extremely important and a lesser actor wouldn't have been able to pull off. And I think it's cool. Like Charlize Theron being in good movies, because weirdly, if you look at her filmography, she's not in a ton of them. And I'm happy to see her become an action star in some capacity, you know? So it's very cool.
Yes. And, yeah. and be good at it.
Yeah, exactly. And I like the way the two play off each other. Did you notice Max's first and last line through this movie?
No.
Okay. Well, it's in the first line is in his opening narration. First thing he says is, "My name is Max." Right. And his last line, comes when he is giving his blood to Furiosa. And
he says, "I am mad."
Yeah, exactly. No, but as he's, you know, as after he hooks up the needle to her, he says to her, "My name is Max." He says the same thing. And it's not quite his last line. He says, "My name is Max." And then there's a little pause. And then he says, "That is my name," just quietly. But at the beginning, when he says, "My name is Max," he says, "My world is fire and blood," or whatever the continuation of that short monologue is. And at the end, his life is still is meant to like he's using his blood to help save another life. You know, he cares about more than just fire and his blood. Now he is transferring that blood into somebody else. And I think there's in all of these quiet moments between the two of them where they really don't say a lot to each other throughout the course of the movie, because nobody says a lot to anybody in this movie. I think there's this small change for each of their characters, and they each affect each other. And I think that's something that helps make their last scene together, as Furiosa is rising up to where Joe used to rule from. Climactic, even though it's not really an action sequence. It's the music, and it's Furiosa rising up and Max walking away. It's like, we've both changed each other. We've both helped each other for the better. And now we're going to go our separate ways, but we're always going to have each other in the back of our mind for having taught each other something and helped each other accomplish something. And I think that's really cool. And I think this movie really would have fallen apart with lesser acting. And there are a few movies I feel that way about, and this is definitely one of them, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's not even as optimistic as that. I think there's also that element we were talking about before, where there's still things that have haunted him. You know, he's given up this blood. He survived, but he's literally lost part of himself on the way. Like, mm-hmm. he's leaving something behind, and he's a bit less than what he used to be, but he's still just going to have to try to continue to survive. And that's this whole movie is about survival. Like, some of the first Mad Maxes are about oil or about families. And I think this one is often very quintessentially just about simply surviving.
Mm-hmm. And Max survived, Furiosa survived, Joe did not. But yeah, thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about whatever it is we talk about next week. All right, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.